Dwell with my soul. That's a good way to do it right before we talk about marriage. We'll see how well it goes for my soul after this.
I laugh tongue in cheek.
Thank you all for doing this panel. We're very excited. So we have about 6 questions we're going to try to get through tonight. And if there's something we missed, just send me an email and I'll hunt Pastor and Jalen down and we'll get you an answer. But we find these questions are pretty, they cross a lot of different topics we need to talk about. So, Pastor, what was a significant decision that you made early in your marriage that positively affected it ever since?
Thank you, Gabe. Let me just say, you know, it's not like we're marriage experts. We've worked it out over the years, and so we don't have the same, our answers may not fit every situation. But when I realized when Jalen and I were married just a short time, I married a firecracker. That is, she's a very strong personality. She's a very strong person. She's bright. She's intelligent. And we were in agreement that I was to be the head of the leader of our home. But that didn't mean that I didn't need to manage her. I didn't need to corral her. In fact, I needed to find ways that I could help her flourish and help her become all of the person that she wanted to be and all of the person that God desired for her to be. So for me, that meant, and early on, I wanted to be a servant leader to her. I haven't always been a servant leader, but I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the kind of leader that would wash her feet. And so from early on in our marriage, I would try to do things for her that would free her up to do things that she would also want to do. So when early in our marriage, I worked part-time, she worked full-time. I went to school full-time, but I would usually get home before her. I'd try to make sure the house was straightened up. I would sometimes get the dinner on, which was a kind of a crapshoot kind of deal. I would try to do the laundry when I could until I realized that I had left all of her best clothes in the laundry mat one time in a very bad part of town. And when she got home and I so proudly showed her all that I had done with the laundry, and she said, "Where's all of my school clothes?" And I realized that they were back in the laundry mat in the hood. And by the time we got back there, they were all gone. But I say all of that to say, to be a leader means to wash feet. To be a leader means you don't manage your wife. You try to help your wife become all that she can be. And so I have a very strong wife, and she's very gifted. And so I think that was a decision that I made early on.
That served you well. You guys have been married for 40, how many?
Over 40.
Yeah.
Okay. A star. We get a star. Uh-huh. If you're going to give stars to visitors, okay, then we should get a star.
And Ms. Jalen, how do you keep the spark of romance in your marriage through each season of life?
I made her answer this one. I'm a little bit more shy than she is.
Well, I'm planning on being explicit. First of all, I want to start with, had we known the seasons of life that we were facing in 40 years of marriage, I would have been terrified. It would have been difficult to look down the road and to have seen all that the Lord would have us walk through. So we've walked through joy on the mountaintop, and we've walked through the depths of despair together. In over 40 years of marriage, we have had 3 children. There have been seasons of young children, seasons of teenagers, seasons of watching our children marry and leave the nest. We've lost 5 grandparents during the time that we have been married, and Bill has done the funerals for all of them. We've lost his mom, we've lost his brother, and we've lost both of my parents together. And had I known what those seasons would look like, I would have trembled at the beginning of our marriage. But God is gracious that we don't know what all of those seasons bring, so that we're able to walk through those joyful times and we're able to walk through those depths of despair together by His grace. But when you're talking about that spark of romance in each season of life, every season of life looks different. It's much harder to keep that spark going when you have young children in the house and babies and you barely sleep and you just feel like two ships who pass in the night. And so I think we have to develop early on in our marriages some really good habits. One of those would be just physical touch. We have always been very careful to hold hands. We hold hands when we walk together. We don't go anywhere walking side by side, I don't think. We hold hands everywhere we go. And actually, we interlock fingers. I'm not going to hold hands with anyone that like I hold hands with Bill, except maybe my children when they were young and my grandchildren now. Except now I have carpal tunnel, so there are days we have to keep switching sides because my hands go numb. So we hold hands everywhere we go. When we sit side by side, usually one part of our bodies are touching, whether it's our hands, whether it's our legs, our feet, whatever it is, we always try to have some form of physical touch. And even when our children were young, they might be sitting on our laps, but we tried not to let them sit between us.
I prefer it when our lips touch, but the other things are good too.
I was also going to say kiss often. Kiss often in marriage. Kiss often and kiss long. Don't let it go far between the kisses. And don't just depend on those pecks. Make it those romantic kisses. Another way, I think, in the seasons of life is just verbalizing your love. I think sometimes we just take for granted that they know we love them, but we need to verbalize that we love them and perhaps why we love them. I did what I thought was a wonderful thing for our 40th anniversary. I spent 2 months writing out 40 reasons why I love him, and now he keeps bringing them up so that he can remind me. He keeps the list in his desk.
She told me she likes my sense of humor.
I do. I love his sense of humor.
So,
it's
not
kind
always.
Of corny sometimes, but yeah. I love it. And then physical intimacy is incredibly important within the marriage. And I think for both husbands and wives, it's recognizing the differences and the needs of physical intimacy and the ways in which that physical intimacy begins within between a husband and a wife and how that looks. So those are ways to keep that spark of romance. I know you would all like to, all the wives would like me to say, well, it means you go on a date every single week. Well, we could never afford a date every single week. And even now, we go to Mexican Steak Tacos, and that's our date, so we're cheap.
Yeah, and I would say on the romantic part of it, without holding hands, sitting next to one another, telling one another we love one another, it makes it more difficult to have romantic intimacy without those other aspects in your life.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Sir, how do you prioritize?
Now, let me just say this. Sometimes, if you got little children, I didn't want to get into this, but I will get into it.
I think there are little children out here.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything other than sometimes you have to set dates and times, mm-hmm. or you'll find you'll be too exhausted. It's not healthy without relational intimacy. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. How do you prioritize your marriage through each season of life? So,
yeah, thank you. And Gabe, and so we go through all these seasons that Jaylen talked about, and I didn't always do this perfectly. Maybe Jaylen, my kids would have to tell you if I did it well or not. I felt like that my professional career could never be more important than my family life, than my marriage and the raising of my children. So it meant that there were certain things I wanted to do professionally. Writing, speaking, traveling on academic trips and things that I just couldn't do. I just felt like, you know, I needed to come home and I needed to take the kids outside. I needed to bathe them at night. I needed to load the dishwasher. I needed to do things like that, that if I were riding, if I were traveling, if I were doing things that maybe that would have fostered me professionally, if we could understand it in the right way, it would prioritize myself over my family. And I genuinely, and I don't always do this, I don't live in my best moments, I've told churches many times, in my better moments, I lead by washing my family's feet. And in my lesser moments, I lead by doing what I want to do. And so that, I think that's the way I try to prioritize marriage in the various seasons. And so as children started getting married and moving out, it gave me more time to do a lot of other things. But now that I've got seven grandchildren at the house, it's all hands on deck. And so I'm downstairs helping Jay Lynn just keep sanity in the house. And so when she's taking the kids home, grandkids home, I'm running the vacuum cleaner, I'm loading the dishwasher, I'm trying to get up the spills on the floor. So it's kind of reverting back. But for me, the priority had to be my wife and my children over my career, if we wanted to put it like that. I have responsibilities. There's certain things I have to do. There's certain things I must do to be a faithful pastor and professor. But there are other things that I can't do if I want to be a faithful husband and earlier in life be a faithful father. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
And as I get the opportunity to speak with men, sometimes couples, and counseling and things, a recurring theme seems to be that of bitterness. And just, they don't know it, they might not express it, but, you know, it's like, well, they've not, you know, forgiveness and things. So, Jay Lynn, how do you fight bitterness and promote forgiveness in your marriage?
Well, I just want to say straight away that the master forgiver is right here. The message that he preached last week when he said, learn to be a good loser. He's the best loser between the two of us. And I humbly say that in all sincereness. But it's so easy. Bitterness is like a weed. And I think often what we become bitter over are not the big issues. We become bitter over the small issues. We take offense at things that are very, very tiny in light of eternity. We allow things to divide us that really have no spiritual significance. It's more preferences and opinions. And so to fight bitterness is to recognize that we have both been saved by the same Savior, to place the gospel first and foremost, and to remember, I always go back to the end of Ephesians 4, that we are to forgive as Christ has forgiven us, or as God has forgiven us in Christ. And so I don't have any right to hold anything against him. I really don't. And when I do hold it, it divides us. And the division isn't on the part of the one that I'm bitter towards. The division is caused by me. And so we fight bitterness within our marriages. I think first and foremost, we need open communication. We need to express our feelings. But the older I get, the more I realize that so many of my feelings are just that. They're just feelings. And I just need to deal with my sin rather than expressing to him how I feel. And so there's a matter of holiness that enters into every marriage, or should enter into every marriage, and that is, how much of this is just me being angry with him over something that he either didn't know he did, or over something that doesn't really matter, and that I'm to forgive, or whether he knows it or not, or I am to say, you know what, Lord, this is just silly of me, and to move on. And so I think holiness enters into it. If I'm going to live a holy life, I'm going to put my sin to death, and I'm going to seek to walk in obedience to God's word. And when we look at Ephesians 4:32, then I'm going to seek to forgive as God has forgiven me through Christ. And we don't let things go long. If there's an issue between us, we try to deal as quickly as we possibly can. Silence is not golden in a marriage. Silence only begins to allow that seed of bitterness and resentment to take root and to grow. And so silence is not golden within a marriage. But I would say that the main point is I am to love him and to forgive him as God has loved and forgiven me.
I wish I'd have known that when I lost all of her clothes in the laundromat over in the hood in Fort Worth, Texas. I wouldn't have been so frightened.
Let me just say, I live with a man who looks at material possessions as fleeting and temporal. In our marriage, I have lost a diamond earring that was part of a pair that was a wedding gift. And I've
from
lost,
me, I think.
From you.
Yes, yes.
And I've lost a tennis bracelet. And at different points, I've lost as much as $200 cash in our house. And you would think that the average man or woman, even if it had been a man that lost these things, would have just been so upset. But he just looks at me and every single time has said, you know what, sweetheart? It is just not that big a deal. It's only stuff. Don't worry about it. So this is the man who doesn't even have to worry about forgiving because he doesn't even think of it as an offense.
Yeah. Pastor, you've shared your story with us more than 40 years of marriage, and a lot of big decisions have come up along the way, different moves, even coming here. But what are some practical ways to work through decision-making, especially when you don't agree?
Yeah, and again, you know, so Jaylen, she's a firecracker, she's a strong personality, she's got strong opinions, and yet, and she's very free to tell me those, and I need to hear them because she's got insight and perspective that I don't have. She tends to be impulsive, I tend to be slow, so it works out pretty good. Her impulsiveness, I slow her down. She's pulling me along. I'm pulling her back. And so decision-makings have never been that difficult because most of the decisions that we make that are big decisions, we just don't make. We make them together. And I would be out of my mind to make decisions without the person who I respect the most in the world speaking and having a lot of influence into those decisions. Now, I still have to be able to lead sometimes at the end of the day. For example, and she told me I could share these. In fact, she gave these examples to me. When we moved here, we were living in a little two-bedroom apartment with three kids on Southern Seminary campus, and it was just inadequate for a family of five, really, one bathroom. And so she's really, really, really anxious to get a home. And so we're looking, and she's searching, and she and my daughter Lydia, they're driving sometimes 6-7 hours a day looking through neighborhoods and such. And so
I must say, this was before the real internet, this is 22 years ago.
Yeah, she's getting lost in our neighborhood that we're in right now, which is Plainview Subdivision. And so maybe that's why they were going 7-8 hours. But nevertheless, I think there were also milkshakes and ice cream and all kinds of other things involved in the house searches that the boys and I missed out on. But, you know, she was really wanted a house. I had a budget. My budget was too low. We had to work through my budget being upped and upped a little bit along the way, and I'm having to get my mind wrapped around the increase from the Panhandle of Florida to Louisville, Kentucky. And so we found a house. It was within our budget. We put earnest money down on it. We go home, and she says 20 minutes after we get home, I don't want that house. I said, I've signed on it. We've given earnest money on it. She's crying. I don't want the house. So I call the people, and I say, we don't want the house. And so they say, well, we're going to sue you. And I said, well, okay, I understand. I understand this is very difficult for you, but let me just tell you, I will get a lawyer. You can keep the money, but I will get a lawyer because I'm not going to move my wife into a house that she doesn't want. So she says, so we can keep the money. Yeah, you can have the money that we put down, the earnest money. And so that happened On more than one occasion, though, there was only money down a couple of times. Those are very difficult conversations to have with people. But, you know, I want her to be happy in the home that we have within the confines of the budget that we can have. She's, in a sense, the homemaker. She's the one with the vision for the home. She's the one with the greatest passion for the home. I just want a home that she's happy in and that my kids are happy in. And so we set budgets. She pushes the budget. I pull it back. She pushes it. I pull it back. And then it comes out just about where it ought to, further than I want it to, not as quite as far as she would want it to. But, you know, on difficult decisions, if it came down to where a decision had to be made, and this would be just a few times with our children, we were in very much disagreement about how to handle particular situations with all of them at various times. And each of those times, I would finally come down and say, after very long negotiations, very long drawn-out discussions, I would just say, "Sweetheart, I love you. This is the way that it will be." And that would put an end to it. But I want to give her, she's too bright and too godly for me not to hear what she has to say and take it very serious. Her opinion matters more to me than any other opinion in the entire world. I don't care what book I read, what preacher I hear, her opinion matters most to me because she knows us best and God uses her most in my life. And I think a lot of complementarians need to read the book about washing your wife's feet and not bossing your wife around. Servant leadership is Jesus' leadership. And when decisions have to be made, I can step in. You've seen me over the years, Gabriel. You've worked with me for how many years?
Well, so as an intern, for about 10 years now.
10 years. I let things go unless I have a strong opinion about it, then I make that opinion known, don't I? And people might think, well, he doesn't have much of it. I've got an opinion, and I'll make it known when it's time to make it known.
I will say that you switch roles with the church budget, and Jeff becomes you, and you're Miss Jay Lynn.
You know, that's the great thing. That's why the staff comes to me when he's out of town. We had the best time while he's been on his 25th wedding anniversary. We had an unbelievable time. Now, the budget's in turmoil, but it was fun, wasn't it?
It was a great time.
Yeah, thank you.
I will say, the staff calls Jeff Dad, and they call Bill Papa.
I like that. Yeah. Everybody loves Papa more than Dad. Ask my grandchildren.
Jay, what are some practical ways to encourage your spouse when they are discouraged?
Well, I think that learning how to encourage a spouse, whether it's a wife encouraging a husband or a husband encouraging a wife, ought to be taking place on a daily basis in every marriage. And actually, it ought to be taking place in every home with children as well. But the word encourage means, and I looked at the definition, it means to give support, confidence, or hope. It's to make someone more determined. And the synonym for encouragement is to cheer or motivate. So it reminds me, yesterday we were at the twins, our 10-year-old twin granddaughters are two of the four girls that are playing basketball right now. And they had the cheerleading squad out for the third and fourth, the little third and fourth grade cheerleaders were out there for the third and fourth grade girls basketball team. And it was priceless to watch. But every time there was a timeout, they would come running out, and they had their pom-poms, and they were shaking the pom-poms, yelling, "Go Cats, go Cats, go Cats." And that's what we ought to be as spouses to one another. It's like being a cheerleader to our spouse or a cheerleader to our children. And so what are some practical ways we can do that? Well, first of all, when we have children or spouses that are discouraged, we should be praying for them. We should be praying for them because often when they're discouraged, that discouragement is real. there's really something taking place in their lives, whether it's a difficult time on a job, for children, whether it's school, whatever it might be, we need to be praying for them. Another aspect of that is to put our critical spirits to death. Bill and I often say, before we ever bring out any kind of criticism or any kind of correction, even with our children or with one another, we need to have been loading up the love bank for a very long time. But sometimes we're so critical of our spouses or of our children that we spend more time adding criticism and criticism upon criticism, and there is no love being put into the love bank. So we need to put that to death. We need to not pretend that that discouragement does not exist. And I'll give you an example of this. For those of you that have been in the church for a while, you know that for 11 months, my mom was dying of COVID. Every 3 to 4 weeks, I was leaving my family and flying to Florida so that I could sit beside my mom's bed as she died. The worst thing that could have happened to me would be for Bill to have, when I would call weeping on the phone, which was every single trip, usually when my mom is sitting beside me because she had no idea what was going on, would have been for him to say, everything's going to be all right, because everything wasn't all right at that point in my life. And so sometimes we think that the encouragement is pretending that there's nothing to be discouraged about, but we need to give them voice for that and give them an opportunity to know that we know that that's real. The other thing that we need to add to that is just consistent words of affirmation. One of the things that I've tried to do with Bill throughout our marriage is to thank him regularly for working and for providing for us as a family. I taught elementary school the first 3 years of our marriage, and then I came home when Lydia was born. And I'm very aware of him, what he's done. And I think, how often do we as wives thank our husbands for working? And if your wife works, you ought to be thanking her on a regular basis and encouraging her as well. We need to be texting one another with words of love and affirmation. We need to use our words, handwritten notes, whatever it might be, so that we are regularly pouring into the love bank of our spouse and of our children, and to be the cheerleaders that we ought to be.
Pastor, the sad situation occurs too often around, at least I've experienced in 10 years of ministry now, that by the time oftentimes people come and tell me or tell us that they need help, they've pretty much already made the decision that the marriage is over. So what are some signs that we need to look for that our marriage is heading in the wrong direction, and how soon do we need to seek help?
And you know, often it is over by the time we're able to get involved. And you know, it's heartbreaking because people begin marriage with so much hope and so many possibilities, but they don't realize, or we don't realize, sometimes it takes hard work, it takes pushing the reset button, it takes continual nurturing and care. Or a marriage is not going to flourish. It's like I said last week, marriage is like farming. We reap what we sow. We reap more than we sow. We reap later than we sow. And so you've got to keep planting the right seeds and pulling up the weeds. And so, you know, what are some signs to look for? One is giving your spouse the cold shoulder regularly. You know, shutting down verbally and emotionally. Now, I want to say this lovingly. That's what children do, not grown adults. Just not talking, shutting down, pulling back. That's not loving your spouse well. It's not honoring to Jesus. And it's only planting really bad seeds. So one is shutting down emotionally and verbally and pulling back physically from one another. Another sign is a lot of fighting. Now, there are times in life that are more difficult than other times. That is, you know, after a baby is born, changing job, there are times that are high stress. But when it becomes a pattern of arguing, and sometimes if people would just stop and they just wonder, how in the world did we get here? We're arguing about all of this stuff when it was just basically about taking the car and getting it cleaned up. And then all of a sudden, it exacerbates out of control. And so regular arguments are not healthy. You're planting bad seeds. There are times, we have times of disagreement. We travel with the Eliffs. They see us in real life. They see Jay Lynn say, I don't think that sweet roll is good for you. I'll say, I'm the husband. I'll eat the sweet roll if I want to eat the sweet roll. You know, you've asked me and promised me that we're going to live long life together. Would you not eat the sweet roll? Listen to me. I'm eating two sweet rolls now, sweetheart. But so
don't,
we say,
don't even ask us about the trip to San Antonio where we had a gallbladder attack on the floor of our hotel room.
Oh, yeah, goodness gracious. So I'll tell you about this one. So we scope out when we go on these trips where Jeff and I are going to eat, and we're going to eat what we want to eat because we're the men. We ate a massive piece of chicken fried steak. Well, I ate most of mine. He ate all of his potatoes and part of his daughter's. Well, that night, I collapse on the floor of the hotel room. I'm in unbelievable pain. I don't know what's happening to me. And she starts crying, and she thinks I'm having a heart attack. And she said, I'm calling Jeff. We've got to get you to the hospital. I had enough wits about me to say, I'll die on this floor rather than have Jeff Eliff take me to the emergency room. I'll meet my maker right here tonight rather than him have that over my head for the rest of my ministry. So, but now back to the question at hand. So pulling back from one another emotionally, verbally, relationally, that's immature and sinful. That doesn't make any sense. Bickering, complaining, arguing. Now we're going to have, again, disagreements. That is a part of living in a sinful world. We're both sinful people. But when it becomes a habit pattern, when it becomes a regular occurrence, there's something wrong. And if she doesn't feel loved by me, or I don't feel loved by her, then we need to have a discussion. And it may be that we need to talk to someone. I think sometimes we're afraid, you know, well, if I call a pastor and get recommendations on maybe a marriage counselor or just meeting with a pastor, then it's a moral failure. It's not a moral failure. It's a very sane, logical, brave, courageous thing to do. Because if your marriage is like a very expensive car, every car needs a tune-up. Every car needs to be kept running well. But if you don't take care of problems when they arise, the problems will only get worse. And the worse the problems get, the greater the situation is. This got to be rectified and undone. And so, you know, if you're having problems, speak to one of us. You know, our ability. Some of us, I don't have great abilities in the area of marriage counseling. Some of us are stronger than others. We have people that we recommend people to that are very, very skilled, very, very well trained, and it'll be the best money that you'll ever invest. It'll be better than a beach vacation if that's what it takes to get your marriage going back, get your marriage back on track. And then the last thing I'd say is this, Gabriel. We didn't have any marriage counseling really going into marriage. We sat with our pastor and he says, you're two of the best people in the church. I don't know of anything I can tell you. You're going to do great. And it was up and down on it. But it's been pretty great. And but, you know, you could learn a lot just by watching people. You don't need like weekly mentors as much as you just need godly friends with godly marriages and godly examples that you can go out to eat with and gather your family together with. We learned most of what we learned about marriage from our from our friends, and then watching people like, you know, Herb and Martha Searles, and to watch, as I've told you before, they're heroes to us. And we watched Bob Golden. Many of you don't know Bob. Bob was out of touch with us for many years because his wife Carol, who's one of the greatest people I've ever met, had Alzheimer's, and we watched Bob care for her. And I've just thought to myself, I hope I can be that good of a man if something like that ever happened to us. But you won't be that good of a person unless you keep your marriage on good terrain. And it's not easy, it's hard, but it's worth the effort. Yeah.
Pastor Jillian, thank you so much.
Church family,
thank you. This should be up on YouTube tomorrow if you want to go back and rewatch it or share it with somebody. And we'll continue our series next Sunday night. Pastor Elif is going to be preaching to us about teenagers raising parents. So that'll be good.
Teenagers raising parents or parents raising teenagers?
He told me teenagers raising parents.
There you go. That's why I didn't call him in the hospital to take me to the hospital. Everything's topsy-turvy with the man. Let me lead us in a word of prayer, and then our praise team is going to come back up and we'll sing a final song together. Father, we thank you tonight for the laughter and for the joy. And Father, even tonight among us, there are very, very good godly couples that I'm sure are struggling in their marriage. And Father, as I was talking to people like the Whitlows and the Brewsters and Judy Jenkins, and just listening to how long all of them have been married, we would all admit that there are difficult seasons. And yet, Father, bad things happen when nothing's done. So those who are struggling, help them to make wise decisions. Help husbands to wash their wives' feet, and help wives to encourage their husbands. Father, fill us with your Spirit as we sing this final song together. In Jesus' name, amen.